Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. Imagine a lush rainforest teeming with color and sound. But then it's gone. No brilliant flashes of blue or yellow from butterfly wings, no peeps and croaks from mud-coated amphibians, and no buzz and thrum from the insects that once made the entire rainforest vibrate with life. Well, that sounds extreme, but it's not all that far off from what a biologist observed in Puerto Rico. And that was before the recent hurricanes. It's just one of a trio of recent reports about the dire state of the world's animals. The World Wildlife Fund found that human activity has decimated global wildlife by 60%. And there's also a Reuters investigation describing a marine life refugee crisis due to warming waters. This hour on Point, reckoning with the man-made catastrophe facing the animal kingdom. And you can join us. Have you seen a reduction in the animal species around you? Birds, insects, or the fish you catch? What happens when foundation species in an ecosystem's food web disappear? And can we turn this around? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me first today in the On Point studio is Bradford Lister. He's professor of biological sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. His recent field research report about the impact of climate warming on ectotherms in the Puerto Rican rainforest was published just this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Professor Lister, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, what you found and reported in your paper was the inspiration for how I introduced this hour. And I know it sounds extreme to say that there's been such a major change in the Puerto Rican rainforest that you've studied for 40 years. But why don't you just start by taking us back to, what was it, the 1970s when you first started doing research there?
Yeah, the mid-70s was the first time I went into the Luquillo rainforest. And it immediately casts a spell. It is the most beautiful, pristine forest I have ever been in my life, and I've been in a lot of forests. It's enchanted, and it's got, you're just surrounded by cascading waterfalls, and by just multicolored carpets of flowers along the roadways. It's just such a special place. I think everyone who has worked there or been through it falls in love with it.
Wow. I mean, you called it an enchanted forest on the Enchanted Isle.
Yes, because they call Puerto Rico La Isla del Encanto, the Enchanted Island, and it really is perfect forest for a wonderful, wonderful island.
So you study insects or ectotherms?
Well, cold-blooded animals.
Cold-blooded animals, okay.
And I'll get to that. But actually, I'm a tropical ecologist, so We're interested in the whole range of species that occupy these forests, their biodiversity, their population dynamics. Are they rising? Are they falling? Mm. And their interactions.
So then in the 1970s, when you first started doing surveys of the Puerto Rican rainforest, I can see the sort of carpet of wildflowers that you're talking about in my mind's eye here. But what did you find in those initial surveys? And how did you measure what the ecosystem diversity was at that time?
Yeah, you have to measure it to see the changes. And the way we worked, we wanted to – at that time I was interested in competition for resources, and it occurred to me that ecologists did a lot of theorizing, but they rarely measured the resources that the animals were competing for. I said, well, how can we change that? So in Panama, graduate student and I set up this method where we were raising plastic plates into the canopy covered with a really sticky substance, just like a fly trap, but stickier, and putting plates out onto the rainforest floor in Panama, and it worked great. I mean, we thought we were having really good samples, and we did that for a week.
So you'd capture all sorts of wildlife, but insects primarily that would stick to the plates?
Yeah, almost always insects.
Okay.
Sometimes you capture a few extraneous lizards, but very rarely.
Okay.
So we decided to go down to Puerto Rico and study competition in the wet season and dry season amongst these anolis lizards, which are a beautiful, remarkable group of lizards that it's undergone many adaptive speciation events on islands in the West Indies, particularly the Big Islands, and they're famous. Jonathan Lossis, who was at Harvard, now at Washington University, and put them on the map. So they're a poster child for evolutionary ecology studies, and I was lucky enough to be working on them in graduate school, continuing my work in Puerto Rico. And we got down there and we said, well, let's put the plates out. So we put the plates out on the forest floor. And we didn't realize how many insects there were going to be, because what you do, you haul up the plates into the canopy in the morning, you uncover the ground plates in the morning, and then you come back at sundown. And the plates would be covered with insects. Huh. So you had a long night picking insects off of sticky plates with tweezers.
So a very teeming with life, to say the least.
I would say so, yes.
And were you discovering insects that had been previously unknown to science?
Well, we did not have the most people would not have the ability to identify these insects down to species. Uh-huh. And that would have taken a long, long time. Okay. So we just classified them into the taxonomic orders to which they belong.
I see. So because you were looking at sort of the whole ecosystem more broadly.
Yeah. So eventually. Yeah. That time we were looking at the lizards and the insects.
I see. Okay. So – but nevertheless, it just took a day for your sticky plates to be covered.
Yes.
Covered with insects. And then in 2000 – so this was the 1970s.
Yes.
Fast forward to the research you did in the same location.
Same location.
2014.
Same – exact same study year, exact same methods. And we went down there because a colleague of ours, my colleague in the field was Andres Garcia from the National Autonomous University of Mexico, and we'd worked for years in Mexico together. So it was very fortunate to have him along. He's an expert field biologist. But we had I had gotten a call from Ray Huey from the University of Washington, who out of the blue said, "Hey, you want to go back to Puerto Rico, back to the tropics, and kind of repeat the stuff we did back in the 70s and 80s? And in a half a heartbeat, I said, I would love to. Let's do it. So several of us went down. What Andres and I went down to do is to actually test an hypothesis of Ray Huey's about the impact of climate warming on tropical animals in general,
yeah,
but especially tropical cold-blooded animals or ectotherms.
Okay.
And what Ray said was, they're going to be much more sensitive to small amounts of climate warming than temperate cold-blooded
right.
animals and insects.
Because they live within a narrow band of temperatures in the rainforest.
Exactly.
It's warm, but within a narrow band.
It's warm all the time. It doesn't fluctuate much at all. And Luquillo is one of the most stable habitats in the world that I could find. I went through world weather records, and wow, Luquillo is just stable.
So you stepped foot in the forest in 2014.
Yep.
And what did you first see?
Well, Andres and I got into the forest. And, of course, he's worked all over the Caribbean, all over Latin America, Brazil. And he said to me, you know, where are the insects? Because you're used to seeing insects just flying by all the time, especially in the Mexican forests. They're loaded with them. And I said, I don't know. What I notice is there aren't any butterflies. And they were teeming with butterflies all along the roadways and the forest. They were just every place all day long. So it was curious. But then again, it could have been a bad butterfly year. You know, you don't know, because these forests are complex systems and they change a lot. And so, you know, we started pawed at the plates in our first evening. We pawed them down and started looking at the ground plates as well, picking the insects off. And it was a lonely plate, because there were very few insects on the plates, and some plates there were no insects, which we'd never seen before.
So you went from in the 70s having these sticky plates being, in a matter of hours, covered with insects, to 2014 having some of these same plates redeployed being empty?
Yes, some of them at the end of the day, all day in a tropical rainforest.
No insects.
Not one insect was captured, right? I mean, it was just astonishing. We just couldn't believe it.
In your paper, you write that due to these surveys that you did in 2014, and we should emphasize this is before the spate of devastating hurricanes that, crossed the island in recent years. But in your paper, you write that for some of the insect species, you estimate a drop in population of 90%?
90 to 98% in biomass. That was for the ground plates.
Okay.
For the canopy plates, it was about 70%. And for our, we also did sweep netting, which is like a big butterfly net, but really sturdy and just sweep through the vegetation and they get captured by the net.
But a 98% loss, I mean, that's 2% short of a total loss of biomass. Have you ever seen anything like that?
The only thing that comes close that I know of was a study in Germany on 63 natural reserves that was published last year. And they measured flying insects primarily, and they found a 75% drop in biomass in Germany. So this is a worldwide phenomenon that insects are crashing across the globe.
I've seen scientists quoted in the media this week saying that your paper is one of the more depressing they've ever read.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's true. It is a very, very disturbing result.
I mean, because insects are, you know, they're wildly underappreciated, I have to say, right? Because there are trillions of them. They really form the basis of many ecosystems around the planet. I can only imagine that if we have a 98% drop in biomass in some in insects in a rainforest, there are animals at higher levels that rely on those insects for food that must be feeling some sort of impact.
Absolutely true, and that's exactly what we found. So I had also census these three species of anoles lizards, the most common species in the forest in the 70s. And Andres and I did that again. And we were certainly expecting, given the drop in insect, these are insectivorous lizards. That's all they eat is insects. We expected them to be dropping. Well, one species had disappeared from the interior forest. I don't think it's extinct, but it just doesn't live there anymore where we had found it before, pretty abundant. And the two other species had dropped about 60% in abundance. So that's a big drop. We weren't expecting that kind of decrease.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break here, Professor Lister. But let me ask you, you were saying a little earlier that the temperatures in the rainforest in Puerto Rico are within a narrow band. How much has it warmed there in recent decades?
Yeah, we found we had two weather stations. One was a critical zone observatory about 3 miles from where we were working, same elevation. And the other one was at Alverde, the field station there, about 4 miles away. And they both indicated about a 2-degree increase in centigrade increase in temperature since the 70s.
And is that a lot?
That's a huge amount for a tropical forest.
So climate has everything to do with what you found?
From our data and our analyses, yes.
Well, we're speaking with Bradford Lister. He's a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute about what he saw regarding insect life in the Puerto Rican rainforest. When we come back, we'll talk to the World Wildlife Fund about what they're seeing worldwide. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about a trio of recent reports that really show that animal life around the world is facing a catastrophe due to man-made reasons, including climate change. And you've been hearing from Bradford Lister. He's a professor of biological sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. His recent field research report about the impact of climate warming on ectotherms in the Puerto Rican rainforest was just published this week in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And Professor Lister says he's observed in among some insects in Puerto Rico a 98% drop, 98% in the biomass of those insects in the Puerto Rican rainforest. And that's over research he's done there for 40 years. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Carrie Cesario. She is Vice President for Forests for the World Wildlife Fund. And the World Wildlife Fund's Living Planet Report 2018 was just published this week. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Carrie Cesario, welcome to On Point.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So you were hearing in the previous segment, Professor Lister talking about what he's observed in Puerto Rico. How does that match, or maybe it doesn't, but how does it match with what the World Wildlife Fund is saying it's seeing around the world with mammals, marine life, amphibians, birds, and insects?
So the Living Planet Report echoes what Professor Lister found in Puerto Rico. These population declines we're seeing across the globe. So the Living Planet Report this week reported that an average of 60% declines in wildlife populations across the globe. So that includes mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, amphibians. And I would also note that those declines are more pronounced in the tropics. So we're seeing in South and Central America declines in wildlife populations of 89%. So it really, I think, echoes the findings in Puerto Rico, and it provides a warning that our way of life is increasingly threatening all life on Earth.
These numbers are hard to fathom. I have to be perfectly honest. I mean, 98% from some insects that Professor Lister has seen, 60% is the World Wildlife Fund says on average of wildlife across the world. As you were saying, 80% of some species in the tropics. I mean, that sounds like a catastrophic collapse over this past several decades. I mean, this is a mass extinction event going on before our very eyes?
So to be clear, the declines don't represent extinctions per se. The report compiles indicators of biodiversity and sort of the health of the planet across a number of different indices and sort of sources of data. So the declines are sort of in the size of wildlife populations. It was surveyed through the Living Planet Index, nearly 16,000 populations of over 4,000 vertebrates. And what we're seeing is decline in the size of population abundance. But you're correct. I mean, these numbers are astonishing. They're shocking. And I think, you know, the comment was made earlier about the depressing nature of hearing these numbers. I think where World Wildlife Fund sees the use of this data is to say we are maybe the first generation to fully comprehend the way humans are changing the face of the planet. But we also are a generation that can create a new historic transformation and reverse those trends. Mm. So I think astonishing, but you know, the question is, what can we do that would be at the scale to avert these disasters?
And I definitely want to talk about that, right? Because we don't want to just feel helpless in the face of these numbers. but let me ask you though. So is the World Wildlife Fund saying though that these precipitous declines are entirely due to human action?
They are largely driven by humans and our increased demand for food, water, energy. When we look across the wildlife populations, certainly overexploitation of wildlife is one of the drivers of this loss. And by that, I mean overfishing, poaching, unsustainable hunting, but also agriculture. So the expansion of agriculture across the globe has led to the conversion of animal habitat, wildlife habitat, to other uses. And that is common across all of the wildlife populations that were included in the report. So one of the big drivers we've seen is agriculture leading to deforestation. So you take the Amazon, for example, almost 20% of the Amazon has disappeared in just 50 years.
Yeah.
The statistic is that we lose 27 soccer fields a minute of forest. So that in itself is staggering. Yeah. And, you know, that's driven in large part by agriculture. So that's food crops, livestock, things like that convert forests and other habitats. But we also see it in marine habitats. So loss of coastal mangroves and corals, also driven by the impacts of agriculture and over-exploitation.
Yeah. So, Brad Lister, let me turn back to you here because, you know, as Carrie Cesario points out about agriculture being a big driver in deforestation and habitat loss, especially in tropical areas, it just seems to me so ironic, right? Because we were talking about insects earlier, and insects are so incredibly important to as pollinators for the very agriculture we rely on. So there's it's a reminder of how interconnected we are to the very ecosystems we're having an impact on. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about sort of the cascade of consequences that you saw in Puerto Rico due to that sharp decline in the insect biomass. Did you see evidence of other species, birds, lizards, and higher up also in decline?
Yeah, we uncovered evidence, very strong evidence of upper levels of the food web also declining in parallel with the insects. And our analyses indicated that rising temperatures were the major driving variable. We finished those initial studies, Andres and I, and we had suggestive evidence. We had the insects declining. The lizards were declining. But we needed more examples. So we were fortunate to be able to analyze data from the long-term ecological research project at El Verde, which is, again, only about 4 miles from where we were. And they had taken data on canopy insects, mm-hmm. on one species of walking stick, maybe one of the bigger species in the forest, and, you'd think would be resistant. They also took data on insectivorous birds and insectivorous frogs in the forest. So we analyzed all this data, and it was the same very negative trend lines.
Right. So, I'm seeing here that, for example, a Puerto Rican bird called the Puerto Rican toady. Is
yes.
that right? It's a
beautiful
a green bird. It relies on insects almost entirely.
It's exclusive insectivore, yes.
And its population declined by?
Its population declined by around 90% or so.
90%?
Well, it was comparative. Yeah. We compared, since we realized that the granivores, which were the ruddy quail doves, they don't eat anything but seeds and berries, they had not declined at all.
Right.
But all these other birds were, sometimes partial insectivores, sometimes obligate insectivores like toadies, they declined relative to the ruddy quail dove. So, yeah, it was the same story. Here's a bunch of insectivores in the forest, and we felt another example of an upward cascade, bottom-up cascade. The resources start disappearing. The things that eat those resources start disappearing. What we don't know is anything about the higher levels, the things that eat the insectivores and on upwards.
Oh, yeah, because I was just about to ask you, how high up can that cascade of negative consequences go?
All the way up.
To us.
Well, in a way. You mentioned a very good point about the pollination. Definitely the moths, the butterflies, and bees were all way down, just like the other groups, the 10 major groups we looked at. So that has right now, it should have very severe consequences in the tropical forest in terms of the productivity, in terms of the species composition. It's happened elsewhere. But in the Luquillo rainforest, we don't know exactly what effect that's having of losing pollinators.
I see. Carrie Cesario, what does the World Wildlife Fund say about, perhaps we shouldn't wait until the effects on human society are obvious because by then it's too late. But are we seeing, what impact this devastation amongst animal life, is that redounding back on human populations anywhere?
Certainly. I mean, to the point about pollination, but also just this broader issue of humans are part of that web. We are reliant on and part of these ecosystems. We're sort of at the top of the food chain in terms of having really impacted the face of the planet. I think we're already seeing the impacts of the loss of nature. If you go to places where ecosystems are already struggling. For example, many places in Latin America and Africa, there are problems with food scarcity and drought. And certainly when we look at recent phenomena with storms, the loss of coastal mangroves, for example, really shows the risks that coastal communities are at without those natural defenses. I think some of the other really direct impacts on humans are on our, you know, in addition to our safety, on our health.
Mm-hmm.
There's evidence where the loss of forests, you see an increase in the incidence of infectious diseases such as malaria. So we rely on these natural systems for everything from the oxygen we breathe to clean water. You know, our food comes from and is the production of it is supported by pollination services, by rainfall, all these things that sort of go unnoticed or maybe underappreciated. But when they're gone or if they are impacted, you know, it's going to be extremely costly to replace any of those systems if we even can. So I think the total is $125 trillion a year is sort of the value of services and products from nature. So nature really powers our industries, our economies. You know, it's not a sort of either or. I mean, we're entirely dependent, kind of at the foundation on nature.
$125 trillion, just to underscore, that's trillion with a T.
And I would say that's probably a conservative conservative estimate.
Yeah, I would say so too.
Well, Carrie and Brad Lister, we actually have a lot of callers who want to join us. So let me just welcome them into the conversation. We're talking about a trio of recent reports that have come out that catalog and survey precipitous declines in wildlife around the world. Bradford Lister has studied insect or ecosystems really in the Puerto Rican rainforest. Carrie Cesario is with the World Wildlife Fund. Their latest Living Planet report was just published this week as well, and want to know what you're seeing out there in terms of animal life around you and whether you're concerned about the numbers we're seeing and how we turn this around. We will talk about sort of points of light and hope, hopefully, as well. But let's go to Claire first, who's calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Claire, you're on the air.
Thanks, and hi, Meghna. Thanks for this wonderful and important show. So I, like many, have noticed the dearth of monarch butterflies, the slow falling off, which has been well documented, and I think many of us are aware of that. But I've just noticed lately that there are no fireflies in my backyard. And I come at this probably from a different perspective than most because I'm a poet, and I feel like my metaphors are dying, and all I'm doing is writing elegies about nature. You know, all these creatures are part of our cultural store of images and our way of kind of making sense and finding truth and beauty in what's out there. So sorry for my emotion. I'll hang up.
Claire, no, don't apologize, please, because I'm sure a lot of us are feeling it. I mean, the way you put it about elegies for nature, that is what this feels like. But hope maybe we can do something to turn it around. But thank you so much for your call, Claire. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I appreciate what the previous caller said, but also I wanted to point out there's a huge epidemic going on with white nose fungus on the bat population across Appalachia, and what that's doing to populations of mosquitoes and other critters that we don't like is pretty profound. And I'd also like to point out that a long, long time ago, we had the bison that roamed much of the Midwest, and the loss of those keystone species is pretty profound. And you don't really need to look really far away from the continental United States to see what this is, you know, the effect that this kind of habitat displacement has done.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Carrie Cesario, let me turn back to you here for a second, because I just want to get some clarity on what the World Wildlife Fund says, because, you know, the specter lurking around all of this and every conversation we have about the natural world these days is climate change. I mean, how much of climate change is driving these driving the fall-offs that you're seeing? Because I mean, ecosystems are complicated systems, but is climate a major part of this? We talked about habitat loss before.
Yeah, so I think to the caller's point, I mean, these systems are interconnected. And so climate change exacerbates all of these other problems we're seeing. And then I think with Professor Lister's work, we're obviously seeing some of the more direct and immediate impacts on wildlife populations. But these things are intertwined. And we, you know, the solutions to addressing climate change are one and the same with conserving biodiversity. So the recent IPCC report noted that halting deforestation was an important contribution to addressing climate change. Well, halting deforestation will help to conserve sort of that nature, that web of life. And so these things are interconnected, and we don't fully understand all the feedback loops, but we know that when things get out of whack, we're starting to see some really concerning trends.
Yeah, so the IPCC report coming out of the United Nations, the International Panel on Climate
Change,
that said that really we have a decade before we've sort of turned a very dark corner on being able to stop carbon inputs into the atmosphere and hopefully getting some carbon out of the atmosphere, which is where those forests come in, as you were saying, Kerry Cesario. But since you mentioned the UN and the IPCC, are there sort of global agreements, global instruments beyond the Paris Climate Accord that we could look to as means by which to preserve and assist the animal life that we've been talking about?
That's a great question. I mean, this is one of, I think, the primary messages coming out of this report that I think we want to call on people, government leaders and businesses to say, we need a deal for nature. Just as we responded to the climate threat with the climate agreement in Paris in 2015, we need a similar global deal at that level of ambition to galvanize effort across borders, across sectors. And we actually have an amazing opportunity to drive for such a framework agreement coming up in 2020. So in 2020, global leaders will be sitting down to review milestones and progress on the Sustainable Development Goals, on the climate treaty, and under the Convention on Biological Diversity. And it's under that convention that we have an opportunity to set new targets that could help drive change.
Well, I'm speaking with Kerry Cesario. She is Vice President for Forests for the World Wildlife Fund. Their Living Planet 2018 report was just published this week. There's a link to it at onpointradio.org. Bradford Lister also joins us as well. He's a professor of biological sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. His most recent study on the Puerto Rican rainforest was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week as well. Again, a link to that at onpointradio.org. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about what's happening in marine ecosystems, so stick with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about a trio of recent reports that really describe global animal life in peril. I'm joined today by Bradford Lister. He's a professor of biological sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. He's been talking to us about a precipitous drop in insect biomass that he's witnessed in the Puerto Rican rainforests. Kerry Cesario also joins us as well. She's vice president for forests for the World Wildlife Fund. Their most recent report, also out this week, says that worldwide animal populations have declined by an average of 60%. And we're joined now by Maurice Tammann. He is a reporter and editor for Reuters. He was the editor in charge of its multi-part series, Ocean Shock, Uncovering the Planet's Hidden Climate Change. That was published this week as well. A link to that at onpointradio.org. Maurice Tammann, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So we've been talking about the jungles and we've been talking about other ecosystems, but you focused on what's going on in marine ecosystems. And the Reuters team has called it an underwater migrant refugee crisis. Meaning what?
Well, I mean, generically speaking, what we're seeing is broad movement of various species toward the poles. So as the temperate regions warm up, you have large groups of fish that are finding it easier to live closer to the poles than they ever have, on both the north and the southern hemisphere.
Oh, and how massive are these migrations north and south?
Well, part of the problem is, there's a line I've heard more times than I care to count, that we know more about the surface of the moon than we know what's going on underneath the water. Being able to see under the water and understand the scope of it is rather difficult. But what we can say is for sure that there are species moving, in some cases aggressively, some cases less so, north and south. Look at the cod population, for example. We didn't get into it in the story, but if you want to catch a lot of cod, you need to go close to the Arctic Circle and the Barents Sea. The traditional areas where cod was caught for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, while there's cod there, it has not rebounded in any substantial way over the last 50 years. Huh. And there are many other species like that.
Well, and so just to sort of bring it home for a minute or two here, you live on New York Harbor, is that right?
I live in New York Harbor, yeah.
On a boat.
Sailboat.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
And
I'm
just
a sailor.
And so what have you seen just in New York Harbor or in the waters that you sail?
Well, the story, the inspiration, or at least the impetus to do this story started when I was sailing just south of the Verrazano Bridge in a place called the Raritan Bay. And I was down there one day sailing, and I saw two dolphin fish dart by me. Now, dolphin fish, Dorado or Mahi Mahi. These are fish that I had fished for and seen when I was down in the Carolinas over the years or in other areas south of there. I never expected to see that fish swimming around my boat near New York. And that got, that was 4 years ago. And over the course of time, I started to investigate and look at different data sets to see if there was any indication that there was something bigger than just an off-chance encounter with an unusual species. And as it turned out, there really was. There were other species over various fishing sailing trips that I saw that didn't seem to fit with where I expected them to fit into.
Right.
That's what started the process.
Well, also, this is truly a global phenomenon, as you and your team reported, because we may have been hearing for several years about lobster populations moving north, but you also write about sardines, Portugal seeing a collapse of their sardine stocks. Interestingly, squid in the Sea of Japan as well?
Yeah, the squid in the Sea of Japan, for sure. And bear in mind, what we wanted to do in the series was not necessarily tell every story, but tell poignant stories about what's happening so people could identify with things that might be important to them or their culture or their lifestyle or whatever it might be. Sardines is interesting because this is not a straight line. The issue with sardines is not so much that they're moving toward the poles, but the juvenile sardines at the larval stage are particularly vulnerable to small changes in temperature. The adults can tolerate it. And so what you had there is a relatively small increase in water temperature with a devastating effect on the population. Now, as a relatively small pelagic, these fish don't live that long. So you do that, you have several years in a row where the larvae are not developing into fish.
Yeah.
You have a crisis, and that's what they have now.
Yeah, but just to underscore what you're saying, it's warming waters that are connecting all of these stories, and not even that.
That's correct.
We don't need that much warming to produce these major effects.
Right. And as I think some of your other guests had discussed, there's a knock-on effect. Why are they catching a ton of tuna in Newfoundland these days? Well, the Atlantic mackerel has decided it's okay to go up there.
Right.
They feel comfortable swimming up there. You see lots of those types of things. The high-level predators are going to go where the things they like to eat live. The pelagics and the forage fish that they feed on are going to go to probably places that allows them to feed and breed in a range of temperature that they like.
Yeah. Well, let's get some more calls here before we run out of too much time. Let's go to Rebecca, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Hello. I grew up in the waters off of Massachusetts in Vineyard Sound, and what I saw as a child were puffer fish and piper fish and eel. And those are all gone. We had a manatee there a couple of years ago. But I think this all started 25 years ago. because you didn't see those fish, hermit crabs. You don't see them anymore, and they were prolific.
Yeah. Rebecca, thank you for your call. Mo Tamman, she's looking back, you know, at least a generation and seeing changes.
Yeah, I mean, when she started looking, I suspect there were still a handful of lobster traps that were really lobster traps in southern New England. These days, you know, except for a relatively small harvest in the Massachusetts Bay, almost all of the U.S. Lobster harvest is in the Gulf of Maine. But it's Gulf of Maine is one of the fastest warming bodies of water in the world. And you're still continuing to see lobster slowly crawl north. Canada has now got a substantial lobster harvest, and I expect that that will continue to grow. And that's one of the fears I think some of the old timers I spoke to up in Maine really worry about, is because they've seen this change over time. And right now they're in the sweet spot, and a lot of people are making a very handsome living fishing for lobster. But the old timers know that it can change, and it probably will.
Well, so that's one of the constant challenges in conservation efforts, right? Because the short-term gains or benefits that we get from nature, even as it's changing, can actually blind us as a community, I think, to the long-term impact. So, Mo, you're exactly right about we ought to be listening to people who've been watching this for a long time. Let's go quickly, if we can, to Mary, who's calling from Pewaukee, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Mary.
Yes, hi. There's a lot I want to say. I share Claire's emotions about the devastation that's happening, and I think we should go into what can we all do.
Yeah.
I mean, my husband and I have seen so few crickets and the monarchs. We grow the milkweed. We have a compost pile. We try a little bit, but I think it has to be on a greater level. Obviously, everyone should be aware of this, so we thank you for your show, and I think we have to fund WWF and public radio, but mainly we have to vote. The way that our government is going now, not even believing and accepting the fact that you know, global warming is mainly because of humans. So it's a devastating situation. We have to vote. That's the main thing.
Well, Mary, thank you for your call. Brad Lister, let me turn back to you here because Mo Tamman has been taking us underwater and guiding us through all the changes we've been seeing there. But as Mary just said, we should probably talk more in the last couple of minutes that we have here about what can we do about solutions. Conservation science and what we know about or the changes in conservation science, does that give us tools to help us support these animals?
Undoubtedly. I think it's made tremendous strides in the past 10, 20 years, and they have a number of tools and strategies that I think, if applied, I mean, it's expensive. So the money has to be there, the willpower has to be there, the governmental support has to be there. But I think definitely we need more focus on what the conservation scientists say, for example, about insect conservation, which isn't a big topic. They're very good at what they do. We need to exploit their expertise because if we don't try to conserve the insects, it's going to be very difficult to preserve the upper rungs of the food web. You know, no matter what we do for insectivorous birds, if there's no food, they're going to not last long. So I mentioned that, and I think it's an unappreciated, somewhat hidden threat to forests around the world, these cascades. And hopefully we'll start getting more data from tropical forests, and we'll start trying to conserve the insects.
Yeah. Carrie Cesario, let me turn back to you here, because you were telling us a little bit earlier about how 2020 could be a pivotal year for conservation if the global community decides to come together. I mean, are there other things we ought to be doing right now, if at all possible?
Certainly. I mean, to the caller's point, I mean, consumers and citizens have opportunities in their daily lives to make choices that show that nature matters. But really importantly, we need to use our voices to be clear with our elected leaders, with our business leaders, that nature is not just a nice to have. You know, it really needs to move up the agenda in terms of policymaking and decision making. So we have an opportunity to remind our decision makers as we vote as we go to the store and what we purchase and in raising our voices. And that's really critical. And that will help to actually pave the pathway towards having a global deal in 2020.
I wonder, though, do we need something even more dramatic? Because I'm thinking back a couple of years ago, I spoke with E.O. Wilson, and he'd written a book basically calling for or supporting the call
half
for
Earth.
Yeah, half Earth, of conserving half the land and maybe areas of the ocean on Earth and setting it aside exclusively for conservation.
Yeah, well, the Paris Agreement showed us that it's crucial to have concrete targets. So we have in that agreement, you know, 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, and that has really focused everyone's attention and made clear what the gap is and what action needs to be taken. We don't have that yet for nature. We don't have a one number that sums up everything that needs to be done. But in the next 12 months, the business sector, governments, NGOs, researchers are working towards coming up with what are those equivalent targets. And certainly the conservation science community is going to be critical in defining, you know, what are those targets and then what are the suite of actions we need to make sure we stay on course. So it's a really, really good point of pointing out, you know, what that combination of preservation, improving how we produce and consume food, how we produce energy, getting a handle on climate mitigation. Those are the three areas where we need to really double down on our effort to understand the feedback loops and also to set really thoughtful targets and good policy.
Yeah. Mo Tamman, I mean, the other thing that I think about is we were mentioning the IPCC report a little earlier in the show. And one of the things that I constantly come away with every time I think about that report is they're talking about the carbon that's already in the air, right? And we may not see the – well, we'll see the continuing effects of that for some time, even if we stopped all carbon inputs today. And so that's going to play out for a long time in our world's oceans, even if we just waved a magic wand at this moment. So it's unlikely that we're going to see a curbing of the level of change in marine ecosystems. Is that right?
Well, I mean, yesterday, there was the report that was released that suggests that we have underestimated the amount of carbon absorbed in the oceans by an order of 60% or something. I mean, the oceans are our great regulator on the planet. Without the oceans, we would just shrivel up and not be here anymore. You know, and if we have reached a point where the planet's water can no longer moderate our atmosphere, that is a scary moment that we're approaching.
Yeah.
You know, I feel sorry for the people who live on the equators. You know, the Russians are going to have lots of fish. The Canadians are going to have lots of fish. Even the Americans in Alaska, even if everything moves up to the poles, there'll be plenty of food. Right. But there's nothing to replace the fish that have moved north and south from the equator.
You know,
you're talking about underwater deserts and starvation on land.
Yeah. I want to try and see if I can sneak in one last call here in just the minute that we have left. Troy is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. And Troy, we just got a couple of seconds here to go, but go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Are you guys willing to give up your car and everything and start jetting around the world to stop global warming? I hear a lot of politicians talk the walk, but they're jetting around the world, destroying the world. Are they willing to ride a horse to work? Are you willing to ride a horse to work?
Well, Troy, you're talking to Troy, just because you ask a good question. You're talking to someone who doesn't own a car and hasn't owned one for 20 years. I walk and take public transit and now rideshare as well. But that's, I guess I'm using a car in that sense. But I think you're asking a really important question, Troy, and thank you so much for your call. Carrie Cesario, let me turn back to you, because the point Troy's making, and you know, we've just got 60 seconds left here to go, is our human societies, especially in the developed world, are built around exploitation of nature. And if we're going to really save it, we have to change the way we live right now. And how many people are genuinely willing to do that?
I mean, that's right. We need to balance our consumption with the needs of nature. And we have an opportunity to do that. I mean, we do have these embedded impacts that we can't change. At the same time, life is resilient, and given a chance, can bounce back. I mean, we have the return of the bald eagle. We have the reforestation of New England. I mean, there are examples where when we have worked kind of at the government level and in collaboration, we can turn back, that we can bend those curves. And so I think now is the time to do that.
Well, Carrie Cesario, Vice President for Forests with the World Wildlife Fund, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mo Tamman, reporter and editor for Reuters, editor in charge of Reuters' multi-part series Ocean Shock. Mo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Bradford Lister, professor of biological sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. It's been so wonderful to have you, Professor Lister. Thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure.
And by the way, if you go to onpointradio.org, we have links to all the three reports that we talked about today. Definitely check them out and let us know what you think while you're there. Final thought here from a listener on Twitter. We've got a lot of these kinds of thoughts. Years ago, Holly Forsman says she used to drive around and her windshield would be spattered with insects. Now there are almost none. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.